Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com, and with me, as always, is my co-host Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Hello, Hannah.
Hello, Charlie.
So we were off last week. We took a break.
Yep.
Sorry if our wide audience missed us, but we're back. And I have a solution to you out there, listeners. If you are too happy, if you are walking around saying, I'm in a good mood, and I'm tired of being in a good mood, I have movies for you to watch back to back. Don't watch them. Don't just watch one of them. It won't work. You might still be in a good mood at the end. Back to back, guaranteed. You watch these movies, you're going to be cured of your good mood. Number one, Natalie Portman's A Tale of Love and Darkness. Number two, The Light Between Oceans. I guarantee you watch those back to back, you don't even want to get out of bed in the morning.
Both titles that I completely interchanged when going to see these movies. I'm like, I'm going to see A Tale of Light Between the Oceans. I don't know. I do think that there's a problem with all the movie titles out there these days because I can never remember them to tell people what I just saw.
They're forgettable. They really are.
I would say at least, well, yeah, the movies are not as forgettable as the titles, except for maybe A Tale of Love and Darkness. Yeah, it was pretty forgettable pretty quick.
Yeah, it's a bland title, and if you don't remember the title, you're not going to remember, oh, did my friend tell me to see that? Did Charlie tell me to stay away from that? You're not going to remember.
Yeah, you just have to kind of go, oh, yeah, that's that Natalie Portman movie in Hebrew.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Well, what we're going to kick it off with this week is the biggest release. It is an adaptation from a best-selling 2012 novel. It's called The Light Between Oceans. It is directed by a man named Derek Cianfrance. He is, this is his fourth film, but he's most famous for 2010's Blue Valentine. That was Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. I liked it.
I like Blue Valentine.
And 2012's The Place Beyond the Pines. I really liked it.
I really did not like that one.
And this one, all right, you can fill me in. Maybe I missed it. We are on an island. We are 100 miles out from the nearest coastline. This sparse, desolate, isolated island with a big lighthouse on it between two oceans. I didn't know where we were. I didn't know what country we were off of. I didn't know what two oceans we were separating. I had no idea.
That's true.
I had to look it up.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I mean, I knew they were somewhere off the coast of Australia.
How did you know that?
I think somebody, because you knew that the lead was a former soldier.
That doesn't narrow it down.
That was from Australia. I think that was made clear at some point early on. Or maybe I had just read it beforehand. I'm not really sure.
Like, it narrowed it down. He'd just come home from World War I and fighting the Germans. Okay, narrows it down. They're in Western Australia. That lighthouse is far off the coast of Western Australia, separating the Indian and the Pacific Oceans. Nobody has an Australian accent.
That's
nobody.
True. Yeah.
They don't even have British accents. They have American accents. Rachel Weisz is in this movie and has an American accent.
No, she has some other kind of accent. I wasn't really clear what her accent was supposed to be, but I don't know.
Alicia Vikander. She's a Swede. She has an American accent.
Yeah, but I think the point of this whole movie, though, is that it doesn't really matter. The setting, knowing the specifics of that, doesn't really lend itself or detract from the movie. I think you are swept away to this island and to this lighthouse, and it doesn't really matter where you are because the heart of the movie is the romance between the lighthouse keeper and the woman he marries and the tragedy that follows their developing romance. So I don't think it really matters so much. I think maybe you were harping on the wrong thing here.
I said I had geographic vertigo. But that romance you just spoke of is a subterfuge, and I'll get to that. Look at the movie poster, and it's got all these questions. What would you do for love? Could you always have love? Look at these two. They're so in love. Well, they are for 45 minutes to an hour. And then it shifts, And it's not about them anymore. It's about the choices they make and the consequences of those choices. And love flies out the window. Where do I even want to
begin? I don't know. I think you were watching a different movie than I was. And that this is going to be a very divisive one because I do think that it's total Oscar bait, early Oscar bait.
It will be nominated for nothing.
Oh, but nothing. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it all depends on what comes out between now and then. But Michael Fassbender is the lead. And Alicia Vikander is the female lead. They are very watchable. They're very good. There's definite chemistry between them. Rachel Weisz is only in it for, you know, one third of the movie, maybe.
She gets a heavy load, though.
She does very well with the supporting role that she has in this movie. But it really is for the person who's just looking for that chick flick romantic drama tearjerker sweeping kind of take me away movie into a story that is heartbreaking. It's hard to watch, but you know, I was sitting between two people who had read the book. One absolutely loved it and was bawling at the end in a good way for her, and the other one had read the book and I think, like you, kind of overanalyzed it a bit. Ugh. And did not like it as much. But people seem to agree that it's pretty faithful to the book. And so I think anyone who has read the book and is interested in seeing this movie, they will, I think, be satisfied with it.
I'm going to boil it down, I think, to the one sentence you're going to hear from 80% of the critics. It's gorgeous. It is vividly harsh beauty, gorgeous, and the story stinks.
No, how can you say the story stinks? Because the story is based on this best-selling novel that a lot of people...
Because people buy books doesn't make it a good book.
But No.
Or maybe
it's
they just didn't
adapt
it well.
I think it was adapted from those who have read the book. It apparently was adapted very well. So you can't fault the story when the story is adapted well from a very popular book.
You said it was like this chick flick, but with heavy thing. You know what you just said? It's a heavy Nicholas Sparks.
It is.
So you have...
So what's the problem?
You got Tom. He's shell-shocked. He's home from the war, and he's looking to be left alone. He wants isolation, and ooh, what's the best place for me? Lighthouse in the middle of nowhere. Oops, Tom meets Isabel. That's Alicia Vikander. They get married. They fall in love. They're having the time of their lives.
The other way around. They fall in love. They get married, you know.
Yeah, which is, actually, that show, I'll get back to her on why that happens. She wants kids. She's obviously like 12 years younger than he is. And he's like, fine, let's have some kids. Couple miscarriages. And all of a sudden, as the audience, role. Is it fate? Is it God? Is it coincidence? A lifeboat, a rowboat, washes up on the shore. There's a dead man. There's an alive baby, an infant, a little girl. And Isabel says, no, don't call the authorities. It's ours. No one will ever know. Look, Dad's dead. No one's looking for this kid. It's going to wind up at an orphanage. We're doing the world a favor. And Tom's like, I don't like this, but go ahead. I love you, Isabel.
No, he's very conflicted. And you see that.
He's conflicted
throughout.
For 90 seconds.
No, he is conflicted throughout the entire movie. You see that conflict. And that's the heart of the story, is when the question is, you know, what would you do for love? And is it fate that this baby just showed up? And he, you know, he wants to do the right thing, but he also recognizes the pain that his wife is in, having lost these kids, lost two babies in miscarriages. And so he's trying to figure out a way to kind of keep her happy and sane, because in her grief. And so he gets trapped in this lie. And as we all know, you know, eventually the lie will catch up.
The lie does not catch up. A spark of guilt is lit when he says, okay, let's keep the child. And it jumps 4 years, and he ends up learning where the child comes from. It's not technically an orphan. Rachel Weisz is its mother. It's not a spoiler. See the preview, you'll know. And so he's got this Dostoevsky guilt, this Raskolnikov guilt. He is so, you can look at him and he's dying inside. I'm like, why? You know what? You have a good life right now. And right now, you're going to make a choice and it's going to divide the audience in two. And you are going to end your employment, end your marriage, end your, possibly your freedom, if you make this choice. If you say, hey, my bad. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you what he does, but it's going to split the audience in two. And I think that's what it's supposed to do. You're supposed to discuss the morals of the story. It's not black and white.
I thought you liked those kinds of things. I thought you liked sad, tragic.
I do. I love tragedy. It's manipulative. It wants you to cry. It's saying, here's the Kleenex. I'll give it to you.
So? That's absolutely.
It's manipulative.
But that the story, it is the story that's told in this book.
And he's not believable. He's like, he leaves clues. It's ridiculous.
The clues thing was a little off the mark for me, but I do think that the acting sells the story, and it is beautifully directed, and absolutely the score drives your emotion.
The swelling.
It is definitely a part of this movie, but it succeeds in being just what I think has been given short shrift at the theaters in the past couple of years. I can't think of anything really recently that's been a good, solid, well-acted romantic drama / tragedy that that does just sort of leave you. It's tragic. It leaves you kind of sad, but it leaves you very moved as well. And
you know what movie pops in my mind when you describe that is? Yeah. It's like it's 2005s or 4s, A Very Long Engagement. That annihilated me. And that was a romantic drama tragedy.
Well, we're 2004. I think we're overdue then.
Same war, by the way. Well, that's the one I haven't studied. You didn't give me time to prepare for that question.
Oh,
that's
sorry.
Just one that immediately pops to
mind.
Well,
and, you know, when you think about movies about, you know, these romantic dramas based on a book and based on really difficult moral choices, you know, we had The Choice.
Oh,
and,
man.
And what did we have? We just had Me Before You.
Yeah.
And so when you put this one up against those.
Oh, I didn't see Me Before You. But yeah, I gave this the same amount of stars as The Choice.
Let me guess, 2.5?
2, right there in the 2. You know, there are no.
It's better.
There's no villains in this movie. No one makes choices out of malice. They keep the child and actually convince themselves they're doing good. They don't do it to hurt anybody. And Rachel Weisz and Michael Fassbender don't make their eventual choices to hurt anybody. There's no bad people here.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see who in the audience identifies with whom. They'll say, oh, you know, she was in the right. It had to go this way. And the friend will look at him, have you lost your mind?
Well, and I don't think you necessarily make those choices or be divided, because I think it reminded me of some of those child custody cases that you see where there's like the adopted parents who have raised a child from birth, and then suddenly at 2 or 3 years old, after all the legal wrangling is over, they're returned to a biological parent, and you see this heartbreaking.
So this is ripped from the headlines.
Apart.
This is a Law and Order episode.
In a way, it is. And so those stories don't always have a bad person. But I think the thing that I thought the most is that I did not feel that the child was prepared well by any of these players.
They didn't do that back in 1925.
But I guess not. But at the same time, you kind of felt like she was a toddler. She was old enough to at least be given some inkling as to what was going on when her birth mother was revealed. And so
it's
a tough story.
Then. The story started to hop around then. So you never got to see the explanation, because they just kind of cut like a week later, a month later. You know, it got episodic a little bit then.
It did. But again, I just think that if for somebody who does like a Nicholas Sparks movie and is looking for something that's a little weightier.
Oh, it's a lot
weightier.
It is
very much a weightier Nicholas Sparks
movie. It's morose.
I didn't find it morose. I found it heart-wrenching, and I think there's a difference.
You mentioned the girl. She's good.
Yeah.
Her name's Florence Cleary. She is 4.
Wow.
She is remarkable for a 4-year-old.
Yeah, she was cute. Just adorable. And you kind of got the sense that they probably went with some things that she just sort of did naturally, that some of that was probably not quite scripted, but she was very cute, and I think that added that layer of heartbreaking kind of scenario to the whole thing, is that you really just wanted, in the end, you wanted what was best for the child.
And if 100 people are in the theater, I think there'll be 100 different answers on what is best for the child.
I think sort of just looking, taking a quick look at Rotten Tomatoes, it looks like it's sitting around 50%. And I think that that 50% shows just the kind of divide that this type of movie can yield. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think 5 out of 10, if you're one of the 5 out of 10 that actually would really enjoy this movie, then I think you're going to enjoy it a lot. And if you're a Charlie, then you're not.
if you're trying not to be manipulated. Well, there's a connection from The Light Between Oceans and our next movie, which is called Complete Unknown, and that's Rachel Weisz.
Again.
She took 2 years off of acting from like 13 to 15, and here she is in two movies being released the same week. Complete Unknown is written and directed by a man named Joshua Marston. This is his third film. I remember his first one because it exploded and raked up awards in 2004. Maria Full of Grace, about a drug mule from, I guess it was Central America. So this one is completely different. And it's kind of, it's small, but not in a bad way.
But definitely small. And not completely different, because what occurred to me after watching that one back to back was it was another movie about choices.
Big time. And it's actually about a man who needs to make a choice and a woman who makes too many choices. You can't stop making choices, if you want to put it that way. It's like the plot doesn't kick in for about 30 minutes.
At least.
Is a 90-minute film, and about 30 minutes in, nothing has really happened. It's interesting. The people that are talking are talking about interesting things. It's like a drama in the parlor.
Yeah, I kind of considered it almost like a psychological drama that then becomes sort of a mystery unfolding, and you just are trying to figure out what this movie is about. It also, aside from Rachel Weisz, it co-stars one of my favorite actors, Michael Shannon, who I loved last year in 99 Homes. And so what amazed me is with this movie, you have two really talented actors in what is really a very small feeling movie. And then suddenly, when you talk about it suddenly kicking into gear, for me it didn't kick into gear until even later than 30 minutes in, probably closer to 45 minutes in, when suddenly Kathy Bates and Danny Glover show up
out of nowhere
and are only in it for maybe 10 minutes.
Oh, but that might trigger, be a little long, yeah.
But they trigger a shift in the movie that the movie only took off for me after they sort of appeared in it. And I enjoyed the second half of the movie, but I spent the first half just wondering where this thing was going.
So I'm going to just, as we always do, I'm going to completely disagree with you. I loved the first half of this movie, and the second half just didn't do it for me. It starts off really confusing, these vignettes of Rachel Weisz, and you have to wonder, is she the same person? Is she playing different people? You have no idea what is going on. And then it jumps to Michael Shannon on his birthday. They're throwing a birthday party. He's kind of squabbling with his wife because, are they going to move? Is he going to get a new job? You know, that's standard marriage pressures. And his buddy brings Rachel Weisz, Alice is her name, over to dinner. And Michael Shannon holds it together, but you can tell he is losing his mind on the inside.
Yeah, he knows who this girl is, and he recognizes her. And so it's to just sort of backtrack a little bit. I mean, Rachel Weisz plays this woman who is sort of addicted to reinventing herself. And so over the course of years, she's shifted gears. She's given herself a new name, a totally new identity. She's learned some new skills. I mean, at one point, she's a magician's assistant. She's a nurse. She is some kind of biologist. I mean, it's really amazing. And you don't know whether she's, throughout the movie, you don't know whether she's a pathological liar or whether any of this is true. And that's where this movie is oddly compelling. But I have a feeling it's the kind of movie where if I had been watching it at home, I don't think I would have gotten through the first half in order to get to the second half, which to me was a little more engaging, and Michael Shannon's character got more interesting to me, and the dynamic between those two and the differences in the choices that they're forced to make in their lives at that juncture. It's interesting, but again, it's such a small movie and it feels small. And I could never remember another one where the title Complete Unknown, I kept forgetting the title.
You know, it reminded me a little bit of 6 Degrees of Separation. Very young Will Smith shows up on the doorstep of Donald Sutherland and Stockard Channing. It's got that same parlor feel. I loved that the plot didn't kick in until a half hour in. I got a kick out of that because that's so, what an experiment. I'm glad someone, good on you for trying it. It could have blown up in your face, but I think it works because it's interesting. A lot of people, I think, are going to agree with you. They're not going to get a lot out of this. They're going to think it's small, but I like a good small film after being bombarded with these epic tragedies. You know what? Give me a nice, tidy, indie small film.
Well, that's what's going to be so interesting, to have Rachel Weisz. She's on the same day, two movies are coming out, one in which she does a very good job in a supporting role in what will be a much bigger movie. And then she's also the lead role in this much smaller movie. And it does show her versatility. I mean, it's amazing, even throughout the film and all the character reinventions that her character, that she goes through. It was fascinating. You could just sort of see this physical and emotional transformation that goes on when she changes up her her situation repeatedly over time. And so, kudos to her for really packing her schedule with just very unique and different choices. But they are both movies about choices and the consequences of your choices and how they affect other people.
And she's on a mission. Alice has come home to Tom. So these movies both have a man named Tom.
That's right.
And she, I think, you don't know why. She never says why she comes home. But I think it's because Tom might be the last person to know her. Back then she wasn't Alice, she was Jenny. He knew right. Jenny, and maybe she misses someone who actually knew her. And yeah. She pops a proposal on him. Come with me, Tom. And the whole Kathy Bates, Danny Glover thing, that's almost like a trial run, a dry run, because she sets him up to be like her, a liar. And that's interesting how he responds to that. Does he play along? Does he get the hell out of there? What does he do? And, then the whole thing just kind of winds down. This thing almost feels like it was shot in a weekend.
Yeah.
Real quick. Another one it feels like is Joss Whedon's take on Much Ado About Nothing. A couple years ago, like 2011, 2012.
Yeah.
Love that movie. And it's black and white. So, I'm a big fan of Complete Unknown, just big time.
Yeah, I liked it, but again, I think it's going to be very difficult for it to find an audience, and it does not have a title that's easily remembered, and I just think it's going to get so overshadowed. But it's definitely one that if you like a good psychological drama, it's worth seeking out.
Well, our next one is... I think I'm the only one who saw it. Hannah didn't see it. It's a foreign film. It's Norwegian. And I want to describe it to you listeners just how I described it to Hannah the other night. A man's son is murdered by gangsters, by the mafia. And he has to take revenge on these gangsters with his snowplow. Oh, man. Some people say this is Taken meets Fargo. Because since it takes place in Norway in the winter time, so it's covered in, 20 feet of snow everywhere. This guy is the local snow plower. And this is, he doesn't just plow the road once a day and then everyone is fine. No, people have to queue, wait for the snow plow to go, and then they follow him up the road. That's how heavy it snows. It's like Kill Bill. It's got a Coen Brothers feel. It's got a Tarantino feel. It's very revengey. And the killings, the murders, the revenge, they're very creative. Every time someone dies, their name pops up on the screen with a symbol of their religion. So, you got crosses, you got crescents, you got like a humanist symbol.
Gee, sounds like fun.
Actually, no, I got a kick out of this. And it's for the Tarantino fans. It's for the Coen Brothers fans. It's Stellan Skarsgård, so famous guy. Remember, he was the Good Will Hunting guy.
Right.
And he's with this Norwegian director, Hans Peter Moland. This is like their fourth time working together. And it's a harsh landscape. Just like The Light Between Oceans is a harsh landscape. This is also, this is way up in the north, and you can't do anything because of the snow. You're snowbound. But it's also a black comedy. It's got this wry humor. The mafia guy has half custody, joint custody with his like 8-year-old son, and he yells at his henchmen all the time about forgetting fruit for his lunch and taking care of the child. And it's funny. I laughed a lot. The second half lost a little steam, so it's not like this isn't some 3.5-4-star film. This is a good 3 action thriller revenge. I got a kick out of this.
And In Order of Disappearance, did you get the name? Is that what it's called?
It's called In Order of Disappearance, and someone mentioned it's in this new subgenre that people are calling the Red Snow genre, like Dead Snow or any of these things that take place in wintertime and, when someone's died because the snow turns red. And In Order of Disappearance, it actually was filmed like in 2014. It's just now getting an American release. I think it's already been released in Norway. And I hope this, it's not like a cult classic. It's not that weighty, but it's such a good time.
Well, I did get the link, so I'll see if I can.
You're not going to watch it. Don't lie.
I'm probably not, but if I do watch it, it'll be interesting to see what I think. But yes, I am not one of those folks that really loves a Tarantino film, or I'm very divided usually on Coen brother films. So I'm not sure anything described as the Norwegian Fargo will necessarily attract me to watch it. But how you can give that one 3 stars, though, and sing the praises of a movie about, like, killing in the snow, and then, bash poor Light Between the Oceans.
Because In Order of Disappearance was not manipulative. It wasn't.
How do you... I think you are manipulated in a different fashion than the rest of us might be manipulated in a movie.
In the action genre, In Order of Disappearance is one of the stronger films. The Light Between Oceans is this stale, I've seen it before thing in the romantic drama department.
Yeah, well, I think that just goes to show that I like a good romantic drama while you like a good murder.
No, I have nothing against romantic dramas. I am fine with romantic dramas. Make it good.
I think this one is good.
Finally, we watched a documentary this week about the university system. Last year we had a documentary about that. It was about sexual assault on campus called The Hunting Ground. This one is Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities. We've been complaining about these forgettable titles. This one's so long, it's forgettable because it's long, but Starving the Beast is a good, hard title.
I don't think so, because I kept thinking back, I was getting it confused with the Beast of No Nation from last year. And so I was like, Beast, okay, it's this movie, it's called something Beast. And then when I saw the subtitle, and again, it's Starving the Beast, The Battle to Disrupt and Reform America's Public Universities.
And that's a spot-on title.
Oh my gosh, but it is spot-on in that it's a boring title and it's a boring movie.
Hannah, maybe it's just because you were tired.
It could be that I was tired, but I think back to a movie like Waiting for Superman in 2010 that was a documentary about
elementary school,
the shambles of the public school education system. But I liked that movie. I remember actually getting very engaged in that one. This one started out strong for me. It starts out with James Carville giving some sort of commencement address, maybe, in Louisiana.
A very animated speech.
Yes, and he's a very animated speaker, and he was engaging, and I was brought into this movie in the first 5 minutes, and then it just got so dry to me, and it was just talking heads and politics and education system, and it just didn't have the personal hook that made me care. Like, where were the students? I needed to see something a little more personal and some story that was a little more humanistic driven rather than just a bunch of politicians and a bunch of administrators. It just failed to keep me engaged after about 15 minutes.
No, it's really what you feel about the value of education. Is education for its own sake good for society? Most of us think it is. Some people think it's a business and they want to quantify it. They want to monetize it. Starving the Beast is, it's a power struggle. It's about political and capitalist forces wanting to reform what we have now, what the universities that we know, and monetize it, which is why state funding is going down, tuition is going up. One guy says, he says it perfectly, for the people who believe in this reform, why should I, as a taxpayer, subsidize you to study Middle Ages poetry? And some of us think, because it's actually good for society in the long run, it's good. And some people think, what a waste of money, go get an MBA. And so I felt the struggle, I felt the two opposing sides, and it takes vignettes from different universities. The closest one to us and the most widely known one was the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. Fired their president in like the dead of night. Student protests, you got to see a little bit of that. So angry about it because they said, you know, she wasn't reforming enough. She wasn't moving fast enough. And that's not what you do at universities. Universities crawl. They don't change fast because they it's not what they're supposed to do. So I'm surprised you didn't feel that.
I didn't, and maybe that was where the fault lies, is that there were too many universities. It bounced around a little too much between, you know, I think there was A&M and, you know, University of Texas, and you were in Louisiana, and I think at one point you were in North Carolina, and it just, I kind of lost track of where the story was going. I understand the point it's trying to make, and it's a valid topic, and it's a valid argument to debate. It's just I did not feel that it was presented in a way that will actually just draw a bigger audience. I think it's a missed opportunity when you have a very interesting and divisive topic like this to not be able to figure out a better way to get people to see it. Something like A Waiting for Superman, I remember, had strong word of mouth. Like, a lot of people continued to see it, and that's what sort of put it out into the spotlight. I just don't see this one getting any traction from word of mouth.
I think it's a difference in depth. This does not skim the surface with pretty pictures and pretty music and cute stories. This gets into policy.
Yeah.
This gets into the administration, the bureaucracy. This is one side, this is who wants to change stuff, and this is why over here I don't want it to change, and this is why it's bad. And they rarely get into what is the problem, how can we fix the problem, is there even a problem? And I think not too many documentaries nowadays, because they don't want to be accused of as being boring, really dive down that deep. Maybe that's what I like it. I like when you get into the details and really find out what people are truly mad about.
And that's really the heart of the problem, is that, yes, it's boring. And when it's boring, enough people aren't going to see it. And then you don't get this really valid topic exposed as much as it possibly could be. I just don't see anybody sitting in a theater and paying to watch this.
I don't think they will. No.
I think there is something to be said for academics will probably really enjoy watching this. And grad students, I think, will get a lot out of watching this. So there is a sort of segmented audience for it, but it's people who are going to already be interested in the topic. And I just don't think it's going to succeed in capturing anyone who isn't already interested in learning more about where this debate lies.
That's probably true with the majority of documentaries, save the handful that break out every year. There's like five documentaries that truly break out. This will not be a breakout.
Right.
I watched this with my wife. She works at a university, and this screwed her into the roof. So I think if you find the right audience, it made her very mad, and she was kind of yelling at it. It's like, no, that's a lie. That's not true. Or you don't understand. She's yelling at the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you screen this on campuses, you're going to get a very big this premiered at South by Southwest. That's a good premiere venue for that in the right town. It's
Texas,
Austin.
Sure.
So this, and it was filmed, a lot of it, at Austin. By the way, it was directed by a man named Steve Mims. I need to throw that out there. But yeah, South by Southwest was the correct place to do it. If they take this on a campus tour, I think that would help.
Yeah.
Big college towns.
Absolutely. No, I agree that it would be a good movie to show on college campuses. you know, have an open discussion afterwards, little town halls. I think that would be really a really wise move. I just don't think it's going to be seen in homes, or, you know, or most people are not going to go and find it in the theater. But I do think you're right. I think it's the kind of movie that would benefit from being put in front of the right audience, and some people will get a lot more out of it. And definitely anyone who works for the university system will definitely probably want to see this one.
All right, very good. To recap, The Light Between Oceans is the biggest release this week, based on a best-selling novel. It looks great. The story is trash.
I totally disagree, and that's the main reason I'm here tonight to do this podcast this week, is to make sure that your review of this movie is not considered the you know, the final word, because I think you are really misguided on this one.
I think I'm in the majority. I think this is going to be a Rotten Tomato.
It could very well be, but I think, again, the 50%, I think if it hovers around 50%, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think if you've got 5 out of 10 people, my guess is that those 5 are going to be women who have read the book and want to see that movie adapted, and will enjoy the adaptation that they see. And the good acting that they see.
Yeah, acting's fine. I would much rather see Complete Unknown, a very small film about choices, not making choices. Got a kick out of it.
I like the second half better than the first. You like the first half better than the second. So I guess if you combine our views on this one, it's worth seeing.
I liked In Order of Disappearance, a Norwegian revenge movie in the tradition of the Coen brothers and Tarantino.
I probably will not bother seeing that one.
I liked Starving the Beast, about problems, reform, disruption on universities. If that interests you, I think you'll like it. If it's not your cup of tea, probably stay away.
Or take a really, really, really big grande cup of coffee with you.
Well, on behalf of myself, Charlie Jewell, and my co-host Hannah Bookdahl, thank you very much for listening.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buckdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.